Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. I am Larry Mueller, and today we're talking birds with Bill Volkert. Bill, a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years, and he's been watching birds for a long, long time. You know, he's got 3,600 birds on his all-time list, or his life list, I guess is what it's called. You may have participated in bird counts this year. What was that experience like? You may have a question about a bird that you're seeing or hearing. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And if you have a bird photo that you want to post, maybe it's a bird you don't know what that bird is, or maybe you just want to post it for the fun of it, we'd love to have you do that on our Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page, The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd love to see your bird photos and questions. And Bill Volkert, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's always great to be here.
You know, this fall was really kind of interesting to me. There were a lot of birds around that, actually a lot of unusual sightings that have been reported.
Well, there's a number of things that just delayed much longer than normal, just simply because of the weather. Hadn't turned until much later in the year. If you remember, it was the week before Thanksgiving, just before the opening of the deer season. The day before, we had 62 degrees, and then it was the first time that it actually plummeted. We got a little snow, and things turned to winter. It was just such a very abrupt change.
Very abrupt.
So most birds are really triggered in terms of when they prepare for and take off for migration by the shortening of the day length. Yeah. They anticipate that coming of the winter season and the shortages of food. But there's always some individuals within the flocks that tend to wait a little bit longer. We used to watch this at Horicon Marsh. We didn't reach our peak of Canada geese until mid-late October. But every year, somewhere between about the 15th and 20th of September, the first ones would arrive. Yep. And then it wouldn't be until things froze up in Canada that the very last stragglers were forced out. So it seems like all the species that migrate tend to have that kind of what we refer to like a bell-shaped curve. The real early ones that start, the real peak when most of them move, and a couple of stragglers that seem to hold out for the last. And because of the weather, there were a number that just stuck around quite late. I'm sure people were surprised to see robins that late into November, but we do have robins that show up almost every year on some of our Christmas bird counts somewhere. There's one or two stragglers that'll stick around. Bluebirds also sticking around quite late. If there's open water, certainly the ducks and geese will hang around quite a long time, even sandhill cranes until the snow accumulates. A lot of them were moving as we got into November and the first week of December. Finally, that snow accumulation pushed them out. And one of the most extraordinary sightings was an Anna's hummingbird. It's a western hummingbird. They tend to migrate mostly west of the Mississippi River, but there are some that will take this shift to come to the east, visit into Wisconsin and surrounding states as they make their way south. We had a bird stick around in Wauwatosa. Last day it was sighted was December 14th. That's a hummingbird.
Wow.
There was a record of a number of years ago, somewhere back in about, I think it was the late 90s or so. We had one that stuck around until early December. And there was such a concern over the bird, there was actually an effort to try to capture it, put it on a plane, and send it down to Florida as an assisted migration. It was a well-intended intervention. But over the years, we've really accumulated more records of these Anna's hummingbirds sticking around in these northern states into November and December and somehow weathering evenings that get way down into, you know, the below zero or certainly below freezing temperatures. And then the next day they're gone. Now, there's always that question. Do they finally just fuel up and say, this is enough and take off?
Get out of there.
Or did they fall off the perch overnight and just not survive? Were they in a compromised condition? That could always be open to question. We don't have the evidence. The bird just isn't seen anymore. But it does remind me that for something as fragile as hummingbirds, there are a few species that live in the very high altitudes of the Andes. So now, they don't experience a summer winter. They're near the equator.
Yeah.
But you're up over 12 and 15,000 feet.
Sure.
And every night it freezes. And these birds go into a torpor. In other words, a daily or nightly hibernation. They just drop their body temperature, heart rate, just to survive till the sun comes up. And then they wake up again and buzz around and find their food and not only survive, but even rear families. and on these high peaks within the Andes, the Andean Hill Stars, and also the Helmet Crest hummingbirds. It's the only place to see them. You've got to get up there at really high elevation. I remember photographing one of the hill stars at 15,500 feet. I was so lightheaded, I could hardly focus the camera. And this guy lives there. So things that we think of as being incredibly fragile, some of these little hummers, they're probably hardier than we think.
You know, Wayne and Chris in Whitewater emailed to tell us that they saw a European goldfinch at their feeder the week before Christmas. They posted to eBird, and the sighting was confirmed. Mm-hmm. And I think Jill put up a photo on Facebook, so I haven't. I'll get to that in a minute. But if you want to see one, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you'll see one.
Yeah, it's quite a colorful bird. Obviously, the close relative to our American goldfinch. It's essentially the European counterpart. A little bit more colorful around the face, sort of a reddish colors that blend in there. And this is a bird, along with also another relative to our chickadee, the European great tit, that has been showing up in Wisconsin with even some nest records. Essentially, they're escapees from the pet trade.
Oh.
And I actually have been carrying on a discussion with the State Ornithological Society, with colleagues within DNR and others in the birding community. What should we do? And here's my concern. We have American goldfinches, we have our tufted titmouse, and also the chickadee, which are in the same family. And here we have these European relatives that are becoming established. And it doesn't matter what we're talking about, plants or animals, we certainly know that invasive species are a concern. And my concern is this: will they be compatible? Will they live side by side and just have another species added here? Or will they actually start to compete with them and be a threat? Well, we won't know until they become firmly established and build up their numbers, which by that time, it's too late to do anything. It's obviously a very difficult and emotional situation. Do we now go out there and try to trap and rear all of these, round them back up again, and get them out of there before they become established? Well, we do have a window of opportunity right now if we're going to make that bold move. I think it's a risky experiment. And I think we've had enough experiences that as we introduce exotic species into an ecosystem, we never know which ones are going to be somewhat benign or which ones are going to cause trouble. And as I said before, once they become firmly established, it is too late to do anything, and that's kind of a risky experiment. But yeah, they are showing up. People will see those at their feeders, and it is a foreigner.
Yeah, foreigner. And there's a nice couple of photos of one now up on our Facebook page.
And if you take a look at it, he's got a really nice front and back picture of it. You'll see that it is very reminiscent of our winter plumage goldfinch. But notice the face markings.
Yeah.
Where ours tends to be a more drab, uniform, olive gray. Here you'll see that black, white marking in with a little bit of red right on the forehead. So, yeah, very diagnostic.
Let's go to Jay in Eau Claire. Jay, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question. I'm not, that good on recognizing it. But what I noticed then is my question. There is a flock of bird, few species. Like, I got cardinals, I got chickadee, I got a couple of sizes of woodpecker. And it seems to me that they come and go together. I was wondering if, for example, I didn't have him on my bird feeder for last 3 weeks, and my bird feeder is right on my living room window, so I get good look at him. And
sure,
of course.
Today, everybody showed up together.
Yeah,
great question. Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, there is safety in numbers, so birds tend to flock simply for safety. Because if you're going to take time to feed, you're taking your eye off potential predators. Well, if you've got a number of your others around you, somebody will always be watching. So that is certainly for safety. The other factor is that studies that we've done on bird feeding is, well, sure, it is nice. We can enjoy them. We can bring them up close. But they still tend to get 75 to 80% of their food in the wild. So in other words, it's more convenience. But it also can be important during severe storms when birds get somewhat stuck with extreme weather. Ice and snow. So what you'll find is that birds are very sensitive to barometric pressure changes. So when we've got storms coming in, they can actually sense that. And then they're going to hit the feeders and fuel up because they don't know how long it might be before they can feed again if we get an ice storm or if we get, say, 6 inches of snow and everything's covered. So sometimes you'll actually see them come in just prior to the storms and certainly right afterwards. Again, we get a little break, they'll fuel up again. And in this, even you know, when we have somewhat steady weather, they come and go in groups. Again, that's for safety.
Yeah, there we
they
go.
Enjoy company.
Yeah, thanks, Jay.
Different species, huh?
Yes, they will mix. And it's not only true in Wisconsin, in our winter birds, and even some of the summer birds, but if you go into the tropics, anywhere in the world, you will see birds moving in what we call mixed flocks. And you can walk in the jungle where it can be just absolutely dead with no activity, and then just like that, a huge flock comes by. They say in some places down in Ecuador and Peru, they've seen mixed flocks with 50 and 60 species in a single flock moving through the jungle. They're all following available food, and they're watching for predators. And so what I find fascinating when I've been down there is that it can be absolutely dead. You can be just struggling to find a bird, and all of a sudden everything explodes, and there's all kinds of things, and then you move on, and that's it. So again, safety in numbers.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Kathy in Sorona, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yes, we live about an hour and a half north of Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm.
We've had two families of blue jays coming to the feeder. We feed the sunflower seeds, a little bit of corn, and then suet in bags. And we have not seen any blue jays yet this year, and talked to a neighbor. We haven't seen any blue jays here, and I'll take the answer out there. I was just wondering if you had heard anything in the northern climes here about the dissipation of the blue jay flock.
I don't think that blue jay numbers have shown any real change in the last year or anything like that. Now, we do know that blue jays and crows are some of the more susceptible to West Nile virus. So when we do the late summer monitoring of West Nile virus, we look for dead crows. They're certainly the first ones that tend to perish. When West Nile virus, more than 10 years ago, first arrived here, yes, there was a decline among both of those species, but ever since, it seems that they have recovered, developed an immunity, and populations are relatively stable. Now, that's looking across a broad region of a corner of the state or the entire state or region, upper Midwest. But if you take a look at any of the wildlife, they're not evenly distributed across the land. And so, yes, blue jays are a widespread, very common general bird, but not everybody's going to have them at their feeder and not all the time. I know in the past we've heard this from people who say in fall time, where have all the robins gone? I had them all summer and they're just gone. And next thing you know, Larry, I have a call here and somebody saying, my gosh, I've never had so many robins.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They're not evenly distributed on the land. And it may also be a factor that perhaps natural food is very available right now, that they're just not that hard-pressed to come to the feeders. And, oh, we had a cold snap. I mean, it got pretty chilly here a week and a half ago. But overall, our winter so far has been relatively mild. And so the birds are not all that stressed. So perhaps they're just not really compelled to come to the feeders. And perhaps there's also something of available food somewhere else that the population might have somewhat locally shifted a bit to take advantage of something. And your backyard is just not a place they're visiting right now.
There we go.
Keep the feeders out. They'll come back.
They'll come back. Thanks, Kathy, for calling.
Yeah, thank you.
Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn talks with the author of a book that looks at what some are calling the next industrial revolution. That's at 2 o'clock. Right now, taking a look at the birds of winter with Bill Volkert, retired DNR wildlife educator. It's great to have him back and great to have you listening in. All our lines are filled at 800-642-1234. But you can also post a photo and question on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Let's turn to Dolores in Kenosha next. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, good morning. I have never seen sandhill cranes before.
Mm-hmm.
And then this past summer, we saw them up on Door County. I was out getting my mail middle of December and heard their classic loud clacking noise.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Looked up 25.
Yeah.
And they're huge. It doesn't matter how high up there. They still look huge. And they were Now, we're right in the city, not too far from the lake.
Mm-hmm.
They were heading southwest. They might have come from off the lakefront.
Yeah,
it's possible. Like, especially the water birds,
mm-hmm.
do they kind of follow streams and, like, the lake edge and that?
Yes, the Lake Michigan shoreline is actually a nice migratory corridor. The birds will follow that because it's, first of all, nearly 300 miles long. It's north and south. And you've got essentially a nice forested edge along quite a bit of that, mm-hmm. so that if you've got to come down, especially for songbirds, you can drop in for food immediately. And it becomes kind of a navigation corridor, same with the Mississippi River. So in North America, any of those north-south geographical features, a lot of birds tend to follow them.
Well, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and sandhill cranes are actually a fairly late migrant. I usually think of the vast majority of them moving around Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
For anybody who's out for the deer season, for the gun season, they should most years see sandhill cranes flying overhead. And that's usually a time also when the weather's changing during that time. So if we get a cold front coming in, those birds are starting to move out. Now, our sandhill cranes are the greater sandhill cranes. If you go to the central western United States, the big flocks that show up along the Platte River on the in Nebraska, that's the lesser sandhill. They're actually a little smaller than ours. There's many more of them. There's probably 800,000 in that population. Ours are about 40 to 50,000. Those birds will go to Texas and over to New Mexico for wintering time, and some of them even in northern Mexico. Ours move over toward Tennessee and then head down towards southern Georgia, northern Florida, depending on how severe the winter is, to force them down. And so mid-December, yeah, those are some of the later migrants. And those birds can tolerate the cold weather. What they don't tolerate is accumulation of snow. It gets hard to find food. So when that finally happens, it's time to pick up.
Yeah.
Some move ahead in advance of that. Others, like we said before, will wait till the very last minute. That's kind of like Christmas shoppers, right?
And I've seen them sometimes flying with Canada geese.
Yes, they'll do that. They don't keep up real long with geese because sandhill cranes, they tend to flap and soar where Canada geese are just cutting through the wind.
Yeah.
They're a little faster of a flyer, but they will get into those flocks for at least local movements. Yep.
Yeah. Thanks, Dolores.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that was great.
And in Arcadia, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Oh, good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
And I have a new species that my feeder. It's all black, black feet, black bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's smaller than a red-winged blackbird, larger than a sparrow. It walks. It does not hop, but it hangs out with the sparrows. Can you identify this bird for me?
Boy, do you have a photo?
Yeah.
No, I don't. It's
that would
black.
Be really helpful. Yeah, it'd be worth a thousand words. Now, there are a number of members in the blackbird family. The grackle is certainly larger than red-winged blackbird. Cowbirds, and we do have the rusty blackbird. Most of those have moved out by now, and those populations have severely diminished for some unknown reason. I'm wondering sometimes if it may not just be a young red-winged blackbird. Sometimes when they sleek those feathers, they tend to look a little smaller in size. I know I've had birds in the hand when I've been bird banding, and I've had people comment, oh my gosh, it just seems so much smaller than they look when I see them perched. So perhaps, you know, because of that body covering of a lot of feathers, bird size sometimes can be a little deceiving. But that's really a common bird for late in the season. And the males don't get that real black with the red on the wing until their second year.
Oh,
so
okay.
Those birds that were hatched out this summer, you may see a little bit of that reddish-orange on the wing, but they can cover that up with the wing coverts. And then you'll see along the back, especially the edging of the feathers, will have a little bit of brownish or tan to it. Those are the first-year birds.
Yeah, they are absolutely. He is absolutely
black.
It's black.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the best. That's a pretty good guess.
I'll roll around in my head. If another listener out there has another guess, we'll certainly
entertain
search a little
it.
Bit. Yeah, for anybody else who can help it. That would be my guess at this point. I'll see if something else comes to mind, though.
All right. Thanks, Ann. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Kurt in Dallas, Wisconsin next. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Larry, about a month ago, I posted a photo to your Facebook page of what I believe to be an albino goldfinch. Kind of an opposite of the last color. This thing was perfectly vivid white with just a hint of yellow on the top of its head.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering how common it is to see something like that. I've been feeding birds my whole life, and I've never seen anything like that one. I could hang up and listen.
Sure. Well, a simple answer is not very common, but then also I should qualify that by saying not entirely unexpected. Albinism can show up in almost any species group. It's obviously a recessive gene, and it's very uncommon, which makes it, I think, extraordinary. And as you described, with a little yellow on the head, not entirely complete albino, but a partial albinism. When we have a complete, pure albino, that means no pigments whatsoever, so that even the fleshy parts, the feet and legs are pink, the eyes are pink. But we can also get birds that have any degree of white within the plumage. So I've seen blackbirds and robins with a little white down each side of the tail, down the middle of the tail, down part of the wing, on top of the head. The feathers come out in what we call feather tracks, like little groups on parts of the body. And this partial albinism can express itself anywhere on those body parts. And it can be really tricky when you've got even a common bird with these white marks and you think you've got something totally new and here's something that should be identifiable because of the white, and it just turns out to be something like, say, a grackle with a partial albinism in it. So always interesting because it does not show up that often, say, in the, you know, one out of several hundred thousand or maybe even million that we may see it occur. Some birds tend to show it a little more often than others, especially robins, geese, because they're so common and there's just that many of them. I guess the odds are a little better. But, yeah, always interesting to see it and very unique when I see something in that kind of plumage.
Thanks very much for calling. We have a number of photos, some really cool ones, on our Facebook page. If you go to Visitor Posts, Becky has a picture of a woodpecker excavation on a tree, a couple of shots.
And as big as that is, that's pileated.
Yeah, yeah, pileated.
Or also pileated. They will just chisel into a tree like no other woodpecker. And they're going for what we call ant galleries. Now, those trees are already dying, and you have that core of the tree is pulpy, and the ants are in there. So they can somehow tap and hear that's hollow. And if there's a food source, yeah, they'll just rip that tree apart. And that's really a great picture. They've really done a number on that tree. And that's not unusual. What also you might want to point out is look at the bottom, the amount of shavings that they've left there. He's got
amazing.
A 1 or 2 foot pile of shavings just built up.
Oh, here's Jamie posted a photo of, she says, Irish robin.
Yeah, they refer to that as robin. That's a European family of birds. And somebody must have been traveling over in Europe. It says in Ireland this October. Yeah, very nice bird. And as you can see, a common backyard bird for them.
Yeah.
We don't get to see those here.
And here's Jill has, she says, crowds, hundreds of them at dawn this morning at Mineral Point. They return again at sunset. Amazing.
Looks like a huge flock of crows.
Yeah, it does look like a huge
flock.
And
you will get some very large roosts of crows during the wintertime. They'll get into these pine stands or pine plantations for the evening for shelter. And sometimes they can number 500, 1,000 or more. And it looks like she had a pretty big flock there.
And Paul sent a great shot of a snowy owl. It was shot it yesterday on the Duluth Harbor ice. It's a pretty bird, isn't it?
Yeah, as always. And this is not a good snowy owl year. The last few years, we've had a number of sightings around Wisconsin. They were quite common and easy to find. This year, the bird watchers are really struggling to come up with sightings. I think we've had maybe 5 occurrences. And that's probably related to an abundant food source up in the Arctic. And again, we talked about how some of these birds survive the winter. Snowy owls live, many of them, well above the Arctic Circle. And they don't even bother to come south as long as there's food.
Yeah.
And, of course, you have to remember, as you go far enough above the Arctic Circle, not only is it extremely cold, but you don't have any sun for several weeks or even months at a time. And yet they seem to get by just fine if there's a lemming food source. When those crash, then they come down.
And another great photo here from Owen. He says, an angry bird, a young great horned owl, I think.
Yes. Yeah, take a look at the top of the head. You can see the down feathers. He hasn't formed the horns yet on it. Those are all down feather yet, so the adult feathers or mature feathers have not really come in on the head. That's usually the last place. and looks like somebody who got out of the nest a little early. We refer to these oftentimes as branchers. In other words, they get out of the nest and they start to clamber around in the trees on the branches, but they're not really capable of flying. Well, some of them take a little maiden voyage. They don't go real far. And if they get down, they don't get up very easily. They can't yet lift their weight up. Those wings haven't fully developed, or the muscles really aren't strong enough. So when they get down, they get a little stuck there, and it looks like he got on somebody's porch.
Yeah.
And that's a defensive posture.
Yeah, very defensive.
He's not putting up anything.
You know what? We've got some sounds here, of speaking of owls, and these are fairly short, like a couple of seconds. So just to give you an idea of what these owls sound like, here's first a female owl. So that's a
great horned owl.
Great horned owl.
And we're hearing that this time of year.
And let's listen to the male great horned owl.
That's a little atypical recording right there, but you will have between the sexes a 5-hoot and 7-hoot is the most common that we hear, and they'll be calling back and forth. And as I say, they're actually calling now. This is when they're setting up territory. They started already in December in earnest. I started hearing them around my neighborhood. And the earliest nesting bird in Wisconsin, they're mating at this time of year, and they'll be laying eggs probably before January's up, early February, and be sitting on eggs through this dead of winter. So that's why it's important not to spook them off of the nest if you have them, because if they're gone for even a few minutes in this cold weather, those will freeze. But they have to start this early because they're raising a good family of young, which take a long time to mature and to get them free before the end of the summer. So they got to start this soon already in the year just to raise that family. And interesting that in the dead of winter, they're sitting on eggs. Another interesting fact is that if you ever come across owls once they're either hatched out of the eggs, that you can see them, or you'll see them out of the nest, they're in different sizes.
Oh.
Now, most birds will lay one egg every day or so, and when the clutch is complete, then they incubate. So a duck will lay, say, 8 to 12 eggs, and they'll slowly add more and more eggs and then incubate so that everything develops at once. That way everybody hatches out, the whole family's at the same age or same stage, and it's a lot easier to rear them. You don't have some still in the eggs, some of them running around the neighborhood. So that's a great strategy. You can't do that as a great horned owl. You can't lay an egg and then just let it sit there and wait till you lay the next one. That's going to be an ice cube. So they incubate immediately, which means that they hatch out asynchronously. You got older ones, and they are actually then, you'll see them in different sizes. They'll be a couple of days apart. The unfortunate thing is they never know how much food there's going to be, so they lay a fair number of eggs as an insurance policy. If there's a lot of food, maybe they'll all survive. If not, some will. Well, what happens is if there's not enough food or some high competition, the big ones may actually kill and eat the younger ones.
Oh.
Kind of a rough family life. You think you got sibling problems.
And here's a fledge, a great horned fledge. Let's listen to that sound. And you could hear the parents in the background.
Right, the parents calling in the background.
Let's listen once more.
I know we've had questions about that call in the past, and you usually hear that in mid-late summer and well into the fall, and it's so un-owl-like that that tends to really throw people. What we really have are the young ones that are still begging for food. The parents are trying to get them out there and be independent long before we get into winter, and they just kind of cling you to the parents and keep begging and calling for food, and you'll hear that screeching quite a bit. And I know over the years I've had a lot of questions on that one.
Sounds like a kid crying almost.
You wouldn't think owl.
Yeah, you wouldn't think owl at all.
Yeah, those are the great horned owls, though.
Let's go to Elaine in Princeton. Hi, Elaine. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling because I have a big problem with chipmunks at my feeder. Not so much the squirrels I can deal with, but the chipmunks are a problem because I have a dog that goes crazy trying to catch them and digging holes wherever their holes are. You know, and they'll pop up out of another hole and run away, and my dog is still digging at the first hole. So I have a big problem. almost to the point where I had to stop feeding birds, which I don't want to do. If you have any ideas of what I can do.
Mm-hmm. Your chipmunks are dormant now. They're all hibernating.
So now I'm safe.
Yes, yeah. For now. They'll be back out in spring, so as soon as the frost comes out of the ground, they'll be back up. And it seems that this past year, I don't know if this was statewide or just my neighborhood, but chipmunks were just off the scales. They were just everywhere. And I don't know what was going on of an abundant food source and a mild winter and a good survivorship and obviously good reproduction to follow. But, yeah, we seem to be overrun with chipmunks this past year.
The type of feeder can have an impact because you can have feeders that don't drop the seed as much.
Right. It's the food on the ground is the first one. And while they are related to the squirrels, they can climb. So a baffle or keep them away from trees so that they can't get at the feeder itself, because I've had them actually hanging right in the feeders. So, yeah, that's what you need to do is modify your feeder so that you're not luring the chipmunks in the first place. So try to do that. Shop around a little bit for a feeder that doesn't have a tray underneath it. And, yeah, that way you won't bait them in. And that they'll try to alleviate that problem, keep them out in the woods and a little farther from home where they belong.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Thanks a lot for calling. Jimmy in Caledonia, it's your turn. Hi, Jimmy.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hey, Larry, thank you so much for taking my call. I love your programs, especially Garden Talk.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Hopefully you can help me today. If not, then maybe you could mention something on Garden Talk. Before, earlier in the program, Bill was talking about the birds, that they might have other things to eat so they don't go onto the feeders. And I was just kind of wondering, because I have big flower beds and I like to plant more and more all the time. I was wondering what kind of berries or what is it that the birds actually go out and feed on besides the feeders then?
Okay, very good. Well, the vast majority of our birds migrate because they're insectivores. So right now there aren't any insects out. That's why they leave. It's the food shortage. The ones that stay are staying here because they've got a diet suitable for winter. And what they're really doing is shifting over to seeds. That's a real big one, which is why we fill bird feeders with millet and cracked corn, sunflower, and the Niger seed.
Yeah.
And when we think of seeds, things like in, say, an abandoned field, some of the wild grasses, the wild flowers themselves, native
cone
sunflowers,
flowers,
cone flowers, those all will retain seeds for quite a long time. The little tree sparrows will eat tiny seeds from, say, goosefoot and ragweed, things like that, that we don't even think is big enough for a food source. So a lot of them are feeding on that, those kinds of wild seeds that are available. To grow that in your backyard, I would certainly think a wildflower garden, especially native plants, your prairie plants, would certainly help. A lot of those don't last all the way through the winter, though. They'll come in and hit them really hard when they're ripening that late summer and fall, and they may deplete that, but it's a food source nonetheless. Another food source for some birds are the dried and now almost dehydrated berries. The robins that are sticking around, that's a big food source for them, and even cedar waxwings that we'll find in wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
They shift over to crab apples. That's a pretty good sized food source for a little a waxwing, but they'll choke those down. Cranberries, the wild cranberries, a high bush cranberry, birds tend to eat that, but you'll see that hanging on through most of the winter, and it seems that those are so tart, they almost have to, the thinking is they have to go through a thaw, freeze, and break down some of that real tartness, and the birds use that as an emergency food source then much later on. Unfortunately, of course, another food source for the berry eaters is buckthorn, and they spread that around the neighborhood.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And the problem there is not only are they spreading an invasive plant, but because it's not native, they also don't get the nutrients out of it that they need, and it seems that it acts as a diuretic, so they're actually losing more food value or nourishment than they're gaining. But yeah, those birds are shifting over to those kinds of foods that remain throughout the winter. Interestingly, also, we were talking about goldfinches earlier and some of these other finches that come in flocks. When I was doing some bird banding around my feeders many years ago, I caught a number of goldfinches, and I was watching for a while, and I could see the little egg bands on them. They hung around for about 7 to 10 days, some maybe up to 2 weeks, and then the flock would leave. but yet I had goldfinches at my feeder all winter. So people would commonly say, you know, I've had the same 20 goldfinches coming to my feeder all winter long. They're there every day. The fact is that these birds have learned they can't keep hanging around the same place because their natural food source is eventually depleted and it's time to move on. So they're like nomads. They don't realize that you and I are going to fill those feeders the next morning again. Nature has instilled in them this idea to keep on the move. So what happens, you fill your feeders, this flock will come in, take advantage of that food, really pound on it for a while, and they feel it's time to go before the food runs out, and another flock moves in to take their place. So these are wanderers in the wintertime.
My feeders are never empty, and I even put, sometimes fresh bread, sometimes dry bread. In the spring, when they were migrating in, it was incredible. All the bread that I cut up in chunks, in little squares, I mean, it was incredible. I couldn't even keep up. There were so many. And then I prepared myself now for the fall, mm-hmm. for the migration going back out, going south. And it was like, I don't know what happened to them. I mean, like you said before, it isn't always the same on the same landscape.
Exactly. And that's what makes it interesting, I think. One thing, if I could caution you a little bit, I would avoid the bread. And the reason is it doesn't provide the real oils and nutrients that the seeds have that the birds need. And especially this time of year, it absorbs a lot of moisture and freezes. So it can be difficult to digest. Yes, the birds will eat it. They'll certainly take advantage of it. But it's not the best food for them.
Okay.
So you might want to shift over a little bit more to the seed mixes and try a little bit of different feeders, some with just sunflower, some with Niger, and some with the mixed seed, and offer a little bit of variety out there. Those are more natural foods, a little easier to digest for the birds, a little more nutrition.
There we go.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thank you
very much.
Appreciate the call. Bill Volkert, our guest. I'm Larry Mealer here on the Ideas Network.
Taking a look at the birds of winter today with our guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. I'm Larry Mealer. Thank you so much for joining us. Questions, call at 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a great photo, a bird photo, or a bird you want to identify, post it up on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mealer Show. And, of course, you can email us as well at talk@WPR.org. In fact, Mary emailed us to say that an Anna's hummingbird was banded and documented on the River Edge Christmas bird count in the Cedarburg area in December of 2015, going back to an earlier conversation. So that's cool. And then looking at Facebook again, Phil King sent a beautiful shot of a northern heria. Beautiful bird. Isn't that a gray?
Yes, that's the male. It has the white on the rump, a little bit of black and on the wingtips, and otherwise this grayish white wash. Yeah, an extraordinary bird. And he mentions here that he just saw the thing hanging in the air for a long time. They tend to hunt by, as we refer to, coursing back and forth over the fields. So you'll see them with the wings held above the back, these deep wing beats, and then just slowly, quietly sailing back and forth. And they both watch and listen for small rodents. Well, on a windy day, they may just hang in the wind like a kite, take advantage of that, so they're not using much energy. And they're usually doing that when they think there's something down there and they're just waiting for it to poke back out again. And so they'll hover up there or just hang for a little bit, waiting for maybe a chance to pounce on something.
Terry in Mass City, Michigan has something for us. Hi, Terry.
Hey, great show again, but then it always is, Larry. Always.
Thank you.
You had a caller called in about a blackbird showed up at the feeder.
Mm-hmm.
Reminded me of something about 5 or 6 years ago I saw here. Probably a little earlier, maybe October, November. Snow wasn't quite here. Lots of finches. And a blackbird I noticed there. And it was unusual. I looked at it, and it looked like a red-winged blackbird, which astounded me anyway, because I've never seen one at a feeder. But it looked a little smaller. It went away. I got my bird books out, looked up to see if red-winged blackbirds even came up here, and they do.
Mm-hmm.
But right next to it was a picture of a tricolored blackbird. And that is what it was. It came back the next day, and now armed with what to look for, there it was. And the red on the epaulet was really red, and white was just right there. And it's a little smaller.
I'm wondering if that isn't a little bit of a variation in the color on that wing patch of a red-winged blackbird.
It was really distinctive, really, really distinctive. And a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the white was bright, and the red was really red.
Well, the only thing
I would... Of course, it's a West Coast bird.
Yeah, that's what I would say. It's confined to California.
I know.
And the population has actually declined out there from changes in agriculture.
Yeah.
So...
Well, I mean, absolutely. After looking at the book, you know, and then it came back. I was fortunate it came back. And I just studied it right with the binoculars and everything. And it was absolutely perfectly that. And which is... And never again. I'm waiting for my camera for 5 years now. You know. But anyway, I wanted to let you guys know that. I mean, it's bizarre, but who knows?
Well, you can never say never,
right? Especially with birds. I mean, they do move, and some of them get caught in the wind, so we never know what'll show up where. So that's I think that's what keeps it fascinating is we not only watch for what is common and what they normally do, but also these extraordinary and unusual sightings.
Here's another photo, a nice photo on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, from Christy, who says, I took this photo on Thanksgiving at my cabin in the UP at Kingston Lake on the Picture Rocks National Shoreline area. That's quite a bird there.
Very well camouflaged. looks like one of the grouse.
Looks like it could be a grouse.
I'm wondering if that isn't
a rusty color almost.
Yeah, female of the spruce grouse, perhaps, because you're getting far enough north where you're into that boreal forest element.
Yeah, it could well be that. It could well be that. Pretty bird, anyway. And then Sue sent
incredible camouflage on it.
A flock of robins came through during a snowstorm last week. They seem to be traveling with a flock of starlings. Two questions. Are these summer robins that have stuck around? What do they eat this time of year? And you kind of answered that a little bit. They'll eat berries, among other things.
Right. That's the main food source for them to shift over because that's about all that's available that'll suit their diets.
Yeah. Let's go to Jimmy in Mayville next. Hi. Thank you for calling.
I believe that is actually a young one of the spruce grouse.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know who's doing that part of the job, but you sure are picking some great guests. Bill... I had the pleasure in the second part of my career after I retired from the fire department of becoming an innkeeper, and one of my assignments was the Audubon Inn in Mayville, Wisconsin, just around the corner from the Hurricane Marsh.
Yes.
And I have to tell you, Bill, even as a non-bird watcher, I watched people come in there from Chicago and the Tri-Cities, from China, from all over the world, to explore some of the very things that you were sort of the pioneer on in the Hurricane Marsh. And what you did for Mayville and Hurricane and Beaver Dam and all the great work you did down there. And just so your listeners know, Larry, that is a phenomenal observation center. And Bill had a lot to do with that. I just want to say thank you, Bill.
Well, I just have to say thank you. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Very generous of you.
Yeah, and that is a wonderful center.
Yes, it is.
Wonderful nature center. Jimmy, thanks again. Rick in Bloomington, we'll go to you now. Hi, Rick.
Morning. How are you doing?
Well, we're doing great.
Yeah,
How are you?
Fantastic. About 5 days ago, this is another comment about a black bird. About 5 days ago on my feeder, I had a bird show up, which I'm absolutely certain is some type of a blackbird, and it had a white eye, which is something that nobody has described yet. As I look in my books, all I can see that blackbirds that would be the size of a red wing with a white eye would either be a Brewer's or a Rusty.
Correct.
The day was cloudy, and it was difficult to see. As I look at my bird books, I can see that Brewers tend to have somewhat of a green to them.
Right. They've got that glossiness, especially around the edge of the wing.
Okay. I did not see that with this. It seemed to show more of a blue color.
And was this at a feeder you saw this or out somewhere in the countryside?
A feeder that I only feed black oil sunflower out of.
Okay. Brewer's blackbird is one that tends not to come to the feeder. It's a bird of wet grasslands. Most of them are nesting west of the Mississippi River out in the edges of wetlands in the prairie states. We do have a little area near the Wisconsin Rapids, Nisida area, where we've got a little nesting population in Wisconsin.
Okay.
They do migrate through Wisconsin, so in spring and again in fall, especially in the more open agricultural areas, if we get large mixed flocks of blackbirds, scan through those, and birders will do this with their binoculars and scopes, and look for the brewers that might be mixed in with them. So at Horicon Marsh, for example, a lot of open farmland up there, and brewers would show up in these flocks periodically. So we get scan through all the redwing flocks and see what else is in there with it. Now, the rusty blackbird nests in the spruce forests of Canada. And that's a bird that has declined significantly. As you mentioned, does not have that glossy sort of greenish or black color on it. And they get the name rusty because as they shift over into the from summer to winter colors, they'll take on from a blackish to a little bit more of that rusty brown color. And not a typical feeder bird, but I suppose that, you know, if they're hard-pressed, they may show up.
And why would he be here, you know, this time of year? I understand that, you know, the migration has been somewhat different than usual, but would I be safe in calling him a rusty blackbird? Because I've never identified one, and I want to put him on my checklist.
Oh, I see. well, again, you want to have a sense of real certainty of what you saw out there. The light color eye and eliminating the Brewer's blackbird is certainly the most likely thing that you're going to have is rusty. It is a somewhat late migrant. I see them coming through in the end of October and through November. I usually pick them out by their call. They've got a real distinctive two or three note little kind of a squeaky call. And you can just hear them up in the treetops.
I haven't seen him since.
Yeah, and I usually describe the call as squeaky or squeakly, and you'll just have that two or three note with a little sharpness to the end of it. And then if they're out in the distance and all you see is a dark bird up there, it's hard to know without binoculars, but that call always gives it away. And yes, they do have that light-colored eye, very distinct from all the other blackbirds, except as I say, the Brewers, which is not going to come into the feeder. Rusty is very uncommon, but I don't think it's entirely unheard of that they may show up for a day or two.
I'd write it on your list, Rick.
Yeah.
Quick question. How often would a person get to see a brambling?
Brambling is a European bird.
Now, what do they look like, Bill?
Oh, I'd have to actually go back in a field guide off the top of my head. I do know it as a European bird. Now, this is a bird that isn't so much, say, in the cage bird or pet trade that I know of. Doesn't mean it isn't or couldn't be an escapee. Who knows what people are keeping. But we do have some of these birds from Europe that will occasionally show up in the United States. They'll actually make a migration and shoot across the Atlantic. So we've had reports of some of those European birds on the East Coast and even in the Midwest that have shown up here.
Would it be relevant if I was to find that picture to send it up to Larry?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right, I'll see if I can't do that. Thanks so much for your time. I really love your show. So,
Thank you so much, Rick, for calling. And please do go ahead and post it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, or even email it to us, and we can... I can shoot along to Bill. Appreciate the call. Ralph in Milwaukee has something for us, I believe. Let's go there. Ralph, hi.
Hi, Larry. Pleased to get through to you. I've been a lifelong birder since Grandma taught me to eliminate sparrows and starlings from her Martin house at the farm years ago.
And those, of course, are not compatible. If you have a Martin house, yes, you've got to keep the competitors out, and that's why Martins have been losing out.
Yes, and I now live in a complex in West Dallas that has an overabundance of house sparrows, which are a detriment to our native songbirds. And I wish every time we have a program on birds, we would emphasize well-meaning people catering to house sparrows are really harming our native songbirds. I monitor with my son a bluebird trail out at Whitnall Golf Course.
Pretty good.
Luckily, we don't have a lot of house sparrows there because it's away from buildings. But in our complex, the manager wanted me to put up bluebird houses, and I said, I'm not going to sacrifice bluebirds to our house sparrow factory. So what I did was just put up feeders and houses for chickadees. And this year was the most successful year for me. I had four chickadee houses fledging their young.
Oh, very
and
good.
Now at least three of those families are coming to my chickadee seed and suet feeders.
Mm-hmm.
What I feed is mostly safflower and a peanut butter suet that I make, and it's hung on the bottom of this feeder that sparrows cannot get at because they can't hang upside down. And it's a smooth side with no perches on it. The chickadees go in one hole, grab a seed, and go out the other hole.
Oh, very good.
I also do like the house finches that come here, but they're peaceful and they don't cause any problems. One of the chickadee families is with the house, it's a pair of house finches.
Mm-hmm.
Another flock has the tufted titmouse, that's up in my son's cabin. They have the nuthatch with them,
mm-hmm.
and the other one has the downy woodpecker with them.
Oh, very good.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
Well, I guess I would offer this as a perspective on house sparrows. They're here to stay. They don't belong here. Yes, they do compete with our native birds. As far as feeding them, well, if you've got house sparrows in the neighborhood, you put out food, I don't know how you can that easily keep them out. Large sunflower may be something they can't handle. But the more important thing is if you're managing a nest box trail, keep them out there to give the native birds at least a chance to nest.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Yeah, it makes very good sense. Ralph, thank you so much. We are going to take a look at the news and weather next and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always great to have him with us to talk birds here on the Ideas Network. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert, talking about the birds of winter and the birds of Wisconsin. Here's a cardinal, and I always love to hear the cardinal song.
And for a lot of the calls to help us remember them, the birders put little phrases to it. And that one, very commonly, we think of the first part was a cheer, cheer, cheer. And then that two note, birdie, 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 cheer, cheer, cheer. And it's a nice clear whistle. And sometimes you have to develop a little mechanism in your head to try to pinpoint these bird sounds. But it's not like learning any foreign language. But these are sometimes little helpful phrases that we use. And there's all kinds of them that bird watchers tend to use to help us remember somewhat the rhythm, the pattern, or something of the bird's voice.
I love hearing the cardinals in the spring when I'm doing my jogging through the neighborhood. We have a lot of cardinals, and they're always fun to hear.
And they'll certainly be singing at that time. But you'll start to hear them tune up as we get into late January, February. We've passed already now the shortest day of the year. Yeah. It'll take a little while before it becomes noticeably longer days.
Yeah.
But by the time you get to the end of January, certainly for anybody, say, who's got a day job or kind of a day routine, you'll notice that afternoon, you've got a little extra time there before the sun goes down. Well, the birds will start to notice that too. And as a result, they're not yet getting anywhere near ready for nesting season, but they'll start to tune up. So the nuthatches may call on a nice, mild, sunny day. The cardinals may make their first little calls out there. We'll start to hear a little bit of those first sounds, which I guess is a reminder that winter's breaking. It's not going to last forever.
Great thing to hear. Jim in Park Falls, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hey, good afternoon. I wanted to just touch base with you guys on the whippoorwill and how the numbers are doing. I did hear a couple of them this summer, but in the past you'd heard a lot more, and I just wanted to get to your thoughts and maybe what's being done to maybe help their numbers rebuild or build, or what's going on with the whippoorwill.
Well, that's a really good question, and it is a bird of real concern. I think anybody who is familiar with the song of the whippoorwill would probably, like you, recognize that years ago there were much more widespread in Wisconsin forests. I live in the northern Kettle Moraine area. We used to hear a few. They're never that abundant. They've entirely disappeared from that area. And it seems that as the numbers go down, what happens is not only is there infrequent calling compared to the past, but the range starts to contract. So in other words, from the outer areas where they aren't that common, they first disappear from there and retreat to the core prime habitat area. So southwest Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin are still some pretty good areas. But even there, it's becoming a little alarming because, just like you, even in what we consider the better habitat for those birds or the core areas, even there they seem to be diminishing a bit. What is the cause? We really don't know. Now, they are insectivores. Their close relative are the nighthawks. They catch large flying insects. Is it a loss of those insects? Is it contamination of that insect food source from pesticides? Is that a problem from here on the nesting ground? Or is it maybe because they travel all the way down into the tropics? Is it problems down there? That's the first real challenge in our bird conservation is, first, we try to keep track. How are they doing? What's out there? And what are the population trends? Are they holding their own? Are they increasing? Or are we seeing a decrease? The next bigger challenge is, well, if they are decreasing, what's the cause and where and what can we do about it? And unfortunately for the whippoorwill, we know that there's a serious decline, but we still cannot figure out what's really driving it, if it's even one factor, and what we can do to reverse it. So, yeah, it is a bit alarming, and it is a concern. One thing we'll notice is, as we wrap up the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas project, we've got several more years to go. Birders are scouring during that nesting season from starting already with the earliest nesters in with the crows and ravens in March and great horned owls through the latter part of summer. We're trying to figure out and monitor just how many birds are out there nesting and where. And we'll take a look then and compare with the first breeding bird atlas of 20 years ago to see what the change was. Because it's not just important to see what birds are, say, coming to our feeder or what birds we might see as we drive around, but where are they nesting and how are they doing? Because that's the one chance they have to actually rear young and add to the population and maintain numbers. That's really critical.
Yeah.
So we'll see where that what that tells us of some of these birds.
And Jim, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn to Ernest in Vernon County next. Hi, Ernest. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I've got double vision in the left eye, and I'm trying to spot birds with binoculars. I have to close my left eye.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to deer hunt and had a 3x9 scope.
Oh, yes.
Which I think would make an excellent, if the crosshairs weren't involved,
mm-hmm.
would make an excellent scope for bird watching, because you can set it on 3, locate the bird, and then easily dial it into 9 and bring them right into focus, but it's not available on the market.
Well, let me offer some suggestions.
Okay.
Two things that you can shop around for, and you can either go to some of the better optic stores here in Madison. Eagle Optics has certainly got a wide range of optics available, or search online as well. One would be a monocular, not binocular.
Right, I've got those.
Yep, so that would work for your one eye, or a field scope, as we call it, or spotting scope, as it's referred to. It is basically a closer range telescope, and they also can have variable zoom on them, and those are very effective. When I'm traveling, usually bird watch, I take my binoculars to first scope things and look for anything close up, and if I see a large flock, say, of ducks or shorebirds at a distance, then I set up the scope so I can really zoom in and look at things at a far distance. And those are very commonly used, and certainly an incredible tool.
Yeah.
But the spotting scope requires a tripod. It's not as...
A tripod or a window mount. That's great if you're doing it out of a car, because your car can use as...
But it's not as portable as... I was thinking of a rifle stock, shoulder stock.
That was the other thing I was going to suggest. Yes, I've actually seen people mount them on a rifle stock. And that way you could hold it that way. Now, you would have to be restricted to somewhat the lower power, because obviously when you really get up there, 30, 40 power, you're not just magnifying the image, but also the shake.
Yeah.
Right.
So, it gets harder to stabilize it. But there's also that problem. When you get over about 40 power with something, it becomes a little more light demanding.
Right.
And then you have the problem of either a little bit of wind or shake, even with a good tripod, or if it's warm out, the heat shimmer at a distance.
Right.
And that distorts the image. You just magnify that, and there's a certain point of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Right. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Dave in Marathon County, we're on to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hey, great show, as usual, Larry and guest. I drive a rural work route in Marathon County every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been, I'm a bird lover, period, but I've been fortunate to have a lot of opportunities to stop my truck and observe big flocks of sandhill cranes, you know, within 50 to 100 feet of me.
Well, you're actually in part of the state where they congregate in some good numbers, too.
Well, here's my question. I've never seen a whooping crane that I know of, but so this fall I've seen at least three or four times I've seen groups of 120 or so out in a cornfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the season was over. This is probably last week in November. And I was going out to the parking lot, out in a parking lot, and it was a clear, sunny, chilly day. And here I hear that noise, and I can't see it anywhere, but I look straight up, and here at cruising altitude, I'm guessing 300, at least 300 feet up.
Mm-hmm.
It was a flock of about 150, but they appeared snowy white from underneath. Will a sandhill crane present that way if the light's right?
Or yes.
Would these have been something else?
No, good question. No, sandhill cranes, that grayish color, sometimes in certain lighting, they can look quite white. And that was a little bit of a problem with the confusion with the whooping crane. Now, whooping crane, you've got a little black in the wing, for one, which is diagnostic. And secondly, whooping cranes, you're not going to see 150 of them. We are releasing them and introducing them into the Nisida area. Another release up at the White River Marsh over in Green Lake County, and also at Horicon Marsh. So we're trying to add to the population because there's only one big population that migrates from Texas to Canada, and we literally have all our eggs in one basket. So we're trying to start a second population, but numbers are nowhere near that. People are seeing whooping cranes, an individual or two or three maybe, but 150, no, our population is nowhere near that high at this point. But, yeah, sandhill cranes can look very whitish under certain lighting conditions, especially looking from underneath. So,
well, thank you very much. I won't go bragging to anybody.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling, Dave.
Yeah, thanks for the call.
Annie in Watertown, hi to you.
Hi. I have a problem. I'm not feeding any birds anymore. The last mm-hmm. 5-6 years, I've had terrible problems with bird droppings. Year-round, they mess the car just terribly overnight. I can't hang laundry out anymore. And short of cutting down all the trees, is there something I can do? I don't know if they're grackles.
Yeah, that's the problem, is that the birds are using the trees for roosting in. And while they're sleeping, they're digesting their food. Either during the day, they may be resting and leaving droppings, or even during the night. Yeah, your problem is the trees, and you certainly don't want to get rid of that because that's such a nice asset to have, both for shade and for some wildlife habitat. If there's some way that you could shelter the car between them and the birds.
Well, it's the whole yard. I mean, you can't, the lawn furniture and everything. I mean, it's only been the last 5 or so years, you know. It's been
is it throughout the summer or just, say, in the fall time when the birds are really flocking?
Year-round.
Year-round.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, I've got it. I don't scrape the ice off. I have to scrape other stuff off.
Well, I hate to say it. You've got some really ideal bird habitat.
Yeah, I guess so.
Which is unfortunate that when all of a sudden you got a really good thing, now you got a little bit of a problem.
I can't feed anymore. I used to have you know, nice birds at the bird feeders, but it's just all these black birds now.
Yeah. And these are blackbirds, and grackles are red-winged blackbirds that are coming in large flocks.
Yeah.
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 Mm-hmm. And it's a fairly good-sized songbird, so you also end up with fairly good-sized droppings and in good numbers, abundant. That can be a real challenge, and you'd hate to try to just scare the birds away because it's also temporary. You know, they make a little noise and something, they'll fly off, and if they find it attractive,
they'll come back
again anyhow. And then, you know, what's more of a nuisance, you trying to make all that noise there? Yeah. If there's any way that you can just simply kind of accept the fact that the birds are being lured to the area and find a way to shelter some of that, that's probably all I could offer a suggestion.
Yeah, you're not going to scare them away.
No.
They
just love it too much. I hate to say it.
I'm sorry. I can't help you on that one, Annie. Short of cutting down the trees, which you don't want to do either.
Oh, that's your real asset.
Gary and Rhinelander is wondering if you know about the Chicago parrots, and he posted a photo on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. This flock has been seen. He's seen them frequently, even in the winter. He's wondering how they got there and how they could thrive in the cold urban environment year-round, and are they found in southern Wisconsin, too.
No, it seems to be a flock that is stuck right in that Chicago area. These are monk parakeets. Mm-hmm. They were in the pet trade. They come from Argentina and Bolivia. So they're in South America, a little bit southern part of South America. So they're not a true tropical bird as such. And they also can live a little bit at altitude in the Andes. So they are somewhat adapted to the colder weather. And, yeah, they've become established in that area. I believe Florida also has a population. Again, something out of the pet trade that got loose, established itself, and has been living there. The Chicago flock's been around for quite some time.
Long time, yep.
Nancy, but they haven't really moved beyond that for some reason.
Yeah. Nancy and Sheldon, it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We used to have meadowlarks back in the late 60s and before that. We have a dairy farm, and now we don't farm anymore. But as the years went by, you know, they always nested in the fields before you cut the hay. Mm-hmm. And now they cut the hay so early. We haven't seen meadowlarks at all. Are there any species around?
Well, there are two species of meadowlarks, the eastern and western. The western likes a little bit shorter grass and tends to be more in the western United States or central United States. The western has really disappeared from Wisconsin. We were at the far eastern edge of its range to begin with, and say the 1950s and 60s, we had a fairly well-established population, and they've really declined. Eastern meadowlark is our common one. They're still around, but their numbers have also declined somewhat, and that is changes in agricultural land practices. So what you have is a grassland bird adapted to the original native prairies that actually did very well with early agriculture when we pastured cattle.
Right.
And so they made a shift. We lost the prairie. We plowed that under for cornfields, but we were pasturing cattle, and they adapted very well to it. But as you pointed out, now we've gone to those clover crops, which are very early hay mowing, and is almost invariably right around Memorial Day. These birds will migrate all the way down into Mexico and Central America. So a long flight takes them a while to get here, and they'll arrive then as we get into late April, May. They'll set up shop, find a mate, start to build the nest, and that's when that hay crop is removed. And that right there has been a real problem for those birds. And so as a result, you know, the way we use land, we either find that there's winners and losers. And
right.
I've always pointed out to people that wildlife is really a product of the landscape. So when we had a native landscape, wildlife was living where what nature provided was available, and where it wasn't available, one kind didn't exist and something else adapted to it. But as humans have moved in and changed land, what we have are just winners and losers. Those that are able to adapt to the changes we make, and some of them actually find benefits, like Canada geese. They love what we're doing. Oh, gosh, get those lawnmowers out there.
Mm-hmm.
They're all over our golf courses and parks and so forth. So they're very compatible to the point of even being a nuisance. Others tend to be the losers. They're not able to adapt. And with that, that's why conservation is important. We have to set something aside of a natural environment for them to maintain their numbers. And that becomes an important blend in land use. Where do we have places for people, and where do we have places for those specialized kinds of animals that are not able to live with us and need what nature provides? And that's really up for us to make sure we protect that.
I noticed that the lady that called, she didn't have any blue jays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we've got blue jays, and this is the first time, but we've seen a gray jay, and I've never seen a gray jay here. I'm sure that we've got a lot of birds, and the Audubon Society was here this last week, and they were counting.
Oh, great.
So hats off to them.
Yes, and I'm sorry, Sheldon is in what county?
We're in Chippewa County. We're right on the edge of Chippewa and Rusk.
Yeah. Gray jay is found in western United States in the mountains and up in Canada, and we've got little populations in northern Wisconsin where we've got a little bit of that spruce forest element where they've established themselves. They can be hard to find, but you're lucky to have
them. You know, those meadowlarks, when we were cutting hay, we would stop. We used to cut with a mower, you know, a sickle and a mower in the later years, and then we'd be moving their nest, you know, moving the birds off, you know, setting them in the one that was already cut, and then after we cut, we'd move them back and
work around them,
Yeah, and, you know, and it's a shame now. We don't see them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it
is indeed. And thank you so much for calling, Nancy. It's nice to be able to talk about the meadowlark.
Yes, and enjoy your gray jay.
Enjoy the gray jay. On Facebook, we have a photo here from Melissa, who says a bad picture with, it's actually not that bad a picture, with an iPhone. Took it in the fall, but says gives you an idea of the unusual birds we can get.
Eurasian collared dove.
Yeah.
And earlier this fall, we made a trip out west to visit some friends, and they're very well established out in the northwestern United States. They're starting to show up in Wisconsin in increasing numbers. Here's again a bird from Europe that has established itself here and continues to increase. So from that core area west of us and also to the south, where they were first introduced, we're finding that those numbers increasing, and it's becoming a more common bird. And, well, she's even got them at the feeders here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those are our birds to be on the watch for.
And that reminds me of a photo I got the other day from someone wondering what the bird was that was eating a dove, and it was a Cooper's hawk, a male Cooper's hawk. And they kind of like to hang around feeders, especially where there
are
doves.
Yes, they do. I saw earlier we had a question about what to do with a hawk around a feeder. Well, it's a two-tiered feeding system. We put out the seeds, we bring in the songbirds, and then the Cooper's hawk finds his readily available food. You don't want to, in a sense, set those birds up as prey then for a hawk. You know, you'll find that for most people, when they finally come in and take the cardinal off the feeder, that's where they draw the line. Now, those birds are all protected, so we can't intervene. But best to do, if you do have a Cooper's hawk that's taking advantage of your feeder, shut down the feeder. Give it about 10 days or 2 weeks. As I said earlier, most of their food is out in the wild. They're not going to starve just because you're not feeding. Let the birds disperse. When that happens, the Cooper's hawk luck will run out. He'll move on, and then you can start your feeder back up again.
Eric wondered about birds, how they make their sounds, and do they have vocal cords? I have the author of a great book on bird sounds and,
yes,
and how birds actually make their vocalizations.
It's not a true vocal cord. They refer to it as a syrinx, but it is the same thing as within that throat that they can produce that sound. And some of the birds have just a single-strand syrinx, what we call the sub-osking birds. These are the fly catchers, so they have a very simple sound.
Yeah.
Others, very elaborate with that double-stranded syrinx, so they can get these harmonics and real nice vibrations. So we get something very flute-like, like the wood thrush, the whistles, the calls, and some of the very exotic ones. But yes, those are produced then primarily that way. Birds do make a few other sounds with their feathers and things like that. But yeah, primarily it's that syrinx acts like a vocal cord, though it's a little different structure.
Do we have, is the bobolink population declining?
Right along with the meadowlark, same thing. It's a bird that, again, responded well to early agriculture, but as we've changed those practices, they're having a more difficult time in those hay fields. And so, yeah, those also. And I've talked to a lot of farmers over the years, and they all have said, yeah, years ago I used to see so many more. But, yeah, it's simply land use changes, and the way we're doing it today has not been compatible for them.
And bluebird nest boxes, a good place to go to get a new bluebird nest?
I would just go online. You can find some good information. The Northern Prairie States Research Center has all kinds of nest box designs. They're a pretty simple structure. The more important thing is the placement of it. Put it out in suitable habitat. How far apart they are. Don't crowd them too close together. And then also the size of the hole.
Yeah.
That'll be important. I believe 1.25 inches, if I remember off the top of my head. But again, check a reference.
Yeah, you can turn them into great owl feeders if you have the wrong size
That's
hole.
That's right. Or you bring in the starlings and you're raising birds you don't want.
Bill, always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Larry, and thanks to everyone else.
Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. He'll be back, and we'll have him on again. Tomorrow, we'll visit with a wine expert. So stay with us. Lots in store.